Why not inviting our dear Bhadra to share a few words of blessing? Spontaneous outflow of your heart, noble heart, Bhadra, please.
Okay. Well, first off, pranam to my gurus and then a few words. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschapadeshtane. Thank you, Lord, for allowing us to gather together in this wonderful Sangha. Thank you, Lord, for the internet. I was just thinking the other day how fortunate we are to have the internet, to be able to gather from all parts of the world and have this topmost valuable jewel of the Sangha. Maybe we'll open our hearts and ears, and maybe we'll open the ears of our hearts and receive the wonderful gift of mercy in the form of bhakti and love, love for the Lord and love for each other and love for the whole creation that we may imbibe today. Hare Krishna, Gaur Premanande.
Thank you so much, Madhuraji, for inaugurating today's circle in such a powerful, hopeful way. There is hope, for sure. As we were talking the other day here, I'm in Cali today, just in case I arrived a few days ago to, I'm in Cali with C. We are all in Cali with K, Kali Yuga, but I'm in Cali with C, City of Colombia. From Argentina on my way up to the US next week, and so on and so forth. And we were talking with Jai Jagannath Prabhu, who is a friend of mine, and he's also visiting these days, about the importance of, not losing hope and the heroic act of refusing to become cynical in the face of so many things that can happen in life and in the world. And there are such a great, quote unquote, great opportunities to become cynical, right? And to become hopeless and to become the opposite of what it means to be hopeful. And again, without being naive, right? As we always say, one extreme, it may be the initial naivete we all need to go through, but the other extreme of the pendulum is like perpetual cynicism, which we don't want to end there. So the middle point between naivety and cynicism is a proper hope, integrated hope, acknowledging everything. So, and again, part of that is the courageous act of refusing to become cynical, refusing to lose hope, refusing to see reality from a negative lenses and always expecting the worst things to happen as the very first option. So thank you, Badra, for those words that somehow, at least to me, remind me to not lose sight of the blessedness that is always the first option available if we dare to look in that direction, right? So pranam to you all again, welcome, very, very much welcome. And to our weekly satsang, our weekly encounters with the truth. We want to encounter the truth as today also I share one memory Facebook reminded me about. Good purpose of Facebook reminds you about some interesting posts you shared some years ago, and this was this one from Carl Jung, where he will speak about spiritual traditions need to provide people an encounter with the truth. Well, if it's just ascribing to dogma, it's close to useless in one point. If there's no personal first-hand experience, that's a genuine encounter. So hopefully today, and not only today, but we have today so far, we can provide each other, be provided, but also facilitate each one the needed experience, the needed encounter with the truth in whatever form, size, shape, breadth, depth we need to encounter it today. And for that, as part of that, we invite any of you, all of you, to present whatever you would like to present in terms of questions, doubts, topics, something you would like to explore, together. It's exploration, as we always try to remind ourselves. The ethic of this type of gatherings is exploration and not so much explanation, right? It's more exploration, it's more conversation rather than conversion. So you can do so by raising your digital hand in Zoom. If you do not know how to do so, you can send a written message in the chat. We will check it eventually. So far we have two raised hands. So if some of you are thinking about raising your hand, don't feel shy and do it. If you don't think about doing it, it's totally fine, but just for me to have an idea in advance how many hands at the four themes to explore we have in. But if something comes up in any moment, feel free to do so as well. So we'll begin with Kanupriya from Berlin, Germany. She's invited to unmute herself and very welcome.
I guess now. Today my question is about the Purushottam month. because I think most of us know it, since some days, weeks, we have this very auspicious month according to the Vedic calendar. At least this is what they say, what is said. That in this month you get much more blessings, and whatever you do, it is counted much more. And I also heard that if you do offenses in this month, it also gives more reaction. So, to be honest, I have a lot of questions and doubts what it is all about, really. For example, in the beginning, I got some inspiration later. Okay, in this month, you should read this chapter of the Bhagavad Gita and offer Gilamb and recite this poem or sloka, whatever. And I felt it feels so dogmatic somehow, and I don't feel a real inspiration from inside to connect and so can you explore a little bit about this topic, please?
Thank you. Yeah, you should have watched our Spanish that sang from last Sunday. That was the topic. So you have a few days to learn Spanish. No, no problem. It's fine. But yeah, interestingly enough, someone asked basically the same question without the specific clarification that you did that I appreciate about sharing your struggle with certain way of approaching the month that feels a little bit rigid to you. So I appreciate the vulnerability of letting that be known. And as you can imagine, you are not the only one, because interestingly enough, when last week someone asked me, just Maharaj, Purushottam month is starting, can you share something? And I did. And then I invited them to the breakthrough rooms and they returned and they asked some of them anything that came, and one of them say basically what you just say now. So you're not alone, kind of, yeah. Subal from Italy is with you on that one. He was the one, and he's not the only one, I can imagine. So, but yeah, it's an important question, because and somehow, since I say Subal and I say Italy, it comes to my mind that last year I remember we went to Italy with Subal and his cousin Diego, and we went to Assisi. Second time I visited Assisi. So we went to Assisi and visited a few. I think for Diego, Subal's cousin, it was the first time. So we went to some of the main places of St. Francis and visited a few churches here and there. And at one point I asked Diego, who was a newcomer to the place, so how is the experience for you? And he put like a mixed feeling face. So I was curious, like, oh, what's behind that face? And he said, I mean, the place is nice. I love Francis, and Assisi is a beautiful town. But and his point was, we are going to too many churches, and I have nothing against churches, he said, but I'm getting the experience, and he owned it himself. He said, I'm getting this experience that when I enter the church, I'm in a sacred space, and then when I'm leaving the church, I'm no longer in sacred space. And I don't like that. So I appreciated the point, right? It was not so much about destroying the church, but it was more about how to continue keeping the momentum of sacredness when I'm out of the church, or without the need of me going into a church or a temple to be in a sacred space. So I appreciated his point. And of course, we were talking about how, well, for some people in the beginning, you need to go to one hyper-localized spot of sacredness because we may not be able to see sacredness anywhere. So, okay, let's begin here. This church, only this church, not the other churches from the other neighbor, only this altar, not your friend's altar, this altar. It begins a little bit like hyper-localized. Then it becomes more generous, still localized to every church or every temple or every altar till gradually, of course, vision expands, every heart, every atom, and eventually there's not a place where the altar is not. But again, who is there to see that? So I'm speaking all this in the context of sacred space, but your question is more connected to sacred time, so to say, a month, a sacred month, which is somehow the sim a similar way of approaching, I will say, this situation. And whatever I'm saying and I will say has nothing to do with, of course, downplaying Purushottam month or any other sacred month we will emphasize in our tradition Kartik month or particular unique days in the year, Gaur Purnim, Sri Krishna Janmashtami, Sri Radhastami, and so on and so forth. But again, there is always this danger, and it has nothing to do with Purushottam month or Kartik or anything, but it's danger of us hyper-localizing sacredness in those days or in those months, and then the month is over and I'm back to the unsacred life, which shouldn't be the case. So ideally, of course, again, as we always say, every month is sacred, every day is sacred, every breath sacred, every moment, time, place, space, circumstance is sacred, because the sacred with capital S is all-pervading, right? Again, we don't have that vision. We are not an Uttam Bhagavat, at least I am not. In case you are wondering, I'm not, guys, so please do not make any personality cult over here. So according to where we are, we may need to begin with some more localized ways of perceiving the divine or the sacred in one place, one month, a few days a year, a few more days a year, even a few more days a year. And yeah, there will be a point when we will be able to be so immersed in sacredness that you lost sight of the Vaishnava calendar. Because you are living into that life. You're living to the calendar, the real life that the calendar is just pointing to. In the beginning, we may not have the chance of, okay, tomorrow is Gaur Purnim, so to say. Okay, we'll prepare, and maybe we start a week before Gaur Purnim, trying to build momentum and anticipate. And hopefully after Gaur Purnim, you reflect back on Gaur Purnim for another week. And then hopefully you have another Vaishnav festival to capture your attention and to keep the momentum of sacredness. Again, it may sound a little bit strategic, but sometimes we need to be a little strategic in terms of how we keep our attention and presence engaged. But again, for some people, that at one point we may need to, some people may have outgrown some of those patterns, or at least the place from which we used to participate in those, right? Like we always speak about, I don't know, Janmashtami, Krishna's birth. In one sense, Krishna is never born, of course. He's the source of everything. And in another sense, Krishna is being born at every single moment, in a new version of himself, in a new way, in the depths of our hearts if we are willing to do so. So we have all good reasons to celebrate Janmashtami on a daily basis. To give an example, right? Of course, some people in the community will look crazy if I put a flyer announcing tomorrow we are celebrating Krishna Janmashtami, and they will say, no, Maharaj, still are a few months. I said, no, but try to get my point. It's because of these. And I make a flyer saying, we will have 365 day in a row celebration of Janmashtami. And I know it can sound a little awkward, but the point is valid, right? From a substantial place, the point is totally valid. I may not announce it with a flyer, but we should live in that spirit. So I will say that, of course, Purushottam Mass it's not false. It's a true month, and it carries its own unique energy of blessedness. And there's always a beautiful. I mean, I would say on one side, it's always a beautiful chance to say, okay, there comes this particular month. I will try to do this unique offering. But as long I will say, I'm speaking for me again, I don't want to sound like I'm telling you what to do. As long as it doesn't come from a place of pressure, from a mechanical place, I need to do that. And if I do not do this, and I have to do that, and it's all about quantity and calculating and gaining. Like gaining devotional points also, right? Sometimes that's, and I totally get that some of us may need that, like that calculative thing, no? Like when these devotees went to Srila Siddhar Maharaj asking, like, if I'm starting practicing bhakti in this lifetime, how many lifetimes will it take for me to reach perfection? And they had like a calculator at hand, basically, along with that question. And Srila Siddhar Maharaj was like, he was not a calculator person, right? So he was like, why you are asking the, why you are even asking the question? Who cares? Right? So in the same way, in the beginning, we may approach Purushottam month or Kartik, okay, I will chant these more rounds and do this ladder, so I gain these extra devotional points. This verse says that every round will count 100 times more, so I will. So still there is some calculation there. I'm not condemning that. But I totally understand if at one point that feels suffocating or getting in the way of the desired mood, so to say, right? Because if I want to love someone, or if I'm in love with someone, as I say before, every day is a special day. Of course, again, you may have the anniversary between husband and wife or whatever, or the birthday of your child once in a year, and there will be some celebration. It's fine, as long as it comes from the heart. Again, it's not like, oh, I'm a mother, and tomorrow is my son's birthday. What to do? I have to make a cake and organize some festivity. I have to. That's not the ideal. But if it comes from a very spontaneous place, there is place to do that. No, if, I wouldn't say no. If you're a mom, you tell your son, "I love you so much, my dear, every day of the year, that we don't need to organize any special celebration for your birthday. It's fine." No gift, no cake. It's my love 24/7 every day. Try if you want to try. But I will say there is a place for those special seasons as long as the rest of the year still remains a special season in its own way. So I'm trying to present it in a way that one doesn't necessarily have to cancel the others. Not that because I want to live every day of my life as a sacred day and moment, I won't celebrate Janmashtami anymore. I won't acknowledge Kartik in any way or Purushottam month or whatever. I'm not saying that. But also, yeah, do not go to the other extreme of become extremely calculative, or as you mentioned, this example that sometimes there are some statements which basically speak more to the fear-driven part in us, if there is that part in us that needs to be addressed. Like, and if you do some offense in this month, that will be even worse than in any other month. That's not for every bhakta. That's not for every devotee to be, how to say, to be touched by those types of statements, right? As we have talked many times. Now, for some, fear-driven bhakti is basically unavoidable for whatever reason. And for other people, that same orientation becomes an obstacle. Becomes an artha, interestingly, we could say. what is favorable for some, it becomes like toxic and dangerous for someone else. And it doesn't mean that the thing was intrinsically toxic and dangerous, but for some, right? I remember the other day I was talking with Satyaraj Prabhu, and we were talking about a few things. And he say, what was that he say? Oh yeah. We were talking about, yeah, people practicing bhakti from a more orthodox place, some other people practicing bhakti from a more heterodox place, and he told me something like, what's heresy for some is nourishment for others, right? And yeah, I couldn't but agree with that. So my answer, if I should call this an answer, my reflections are, yeah, not necessarily run away from the celebration or feel this shouldn't be celebrated, but also the celebration should continue when the month is over, right? Which, if not, we run the danger of over-localizing sacredness, right? To one place, to one time, to one person, to one book, to one tradition. And as I say, we may need to begin from that place. This religion is the best. This book is the highest only revelation. This guru is the topmost acharya on planet Earth. This sacred dam is better than other sacred dams, and this month, and this whatever, right? But I will say, sign of progress is like that at one point feels too narrow, and we need to encompass more. We need more spaciousness. So, yeah, one has to navigate every season according to one's current needs with good guidance and support. But again, I totally understand some people may need to make their list of vows and commitments for this month, and that will help them like to return to from some laxity they have. Sometimes that happens. Someone may realize, oh, I've been some kind of diluted during the last month or year, and I want to use this month that comes now as a, not excuse, but as a good resource for me to get back on track to some degree in some way. Sometimes that can be a case, but for some other in their own journey, they may feel, I'm not seeing the month in that way. I honor the month. I honor the sacredness of the month, but I don't feel the need to make it too much of an adjustment in this month, because that may create too much of a difference before and after that month, and I don't want to create that. So if I can engage with this month or whatever in ways that can spill over and overflow and be a natural continuation of what's coming and continue in a natural way, that's great. But if not, yeah, we don't want to become too dualistic, so to say. Now comes the sacred month. Let's be sacred. Let's be good and do everything good, and then the month is over, and sometimes you go to the other extreme of the pendulum, because in that too much sacredness in the month, there was a lot of repression sometimes also. So sometimes at one point I've seen people just counting the days for the sacred month to be over, right? So they can go back to their normal life. And for me, it's kind of like that was not the ideal spirit to navigate the sacred month to begin with, right? And that you begin in some way, and then you are counting the days for it to be over. What's the message we are giving to ourselves? So, yeah, whatever we do, I will say, let's do it in a way that is coherent, that makes common sense, that is sustainable, and aligned with where we are, without trying to become superheroes from one month to the other. At the same time, yeah, acknowledging the specialty of the month, but also acknowledging that specialty and blessedness is always available, right? Because sometimes speaking about in this month there is extra credit, it may give also the idea that, okay, now God is a little bit more merciful, and after this month he becomes less merciful again. So you better take advantage of the extra mercy. And that can convey a strange notion of the sweet absolute that is not so available at times, when that's not the case. Bhagavan is always fully available. But again, we may need some quote-unquote special months in order to make us ourselves more available to the grace that is always fully available. So sometimes Vaishnav calendars or any calendar from any tradition will have these special seasons. And again, I'm not denying the speciality of those seasons and why they are named as special. But again, God's irreversible grace is present 24/7, 365 years per year, no exception. But we, in our situation, sometimes may need some lofty thing coming, so to say, for us to pay some special attention. And it's special, no doubt, but everything else is special as well, right? So yeah, do not feel guilty if you don't feel, how to say, in months like this, sometimes the both sides see people comparing with each other and seeing what the others are doing, not doing, and some entering a guilt trip, or they are doing all this and I'm not doing this. I'm not taking it so seriously, or, and at the end of the day, it's not about comparing with anyone. As long as one is navigating it with sincerity, and sacredness in one way or another, that's the important thing. Because again, Purushottam month, the month that represents Krishna. But do we want to limit Krishna to 1 month every 3 years? That's a little bit like not generous with poor Krishna, right? You only are manifest 1 month every 3 years, and the rest of the year, the 3 years, you are not so present. I mean, he's present everywhere. In the Gita, he's saying, "I'm this, I'm this of this month, and this species, and this and that." So, it's a particular way of capturing our attention with something real, not with something false. And we're invited to take proper advantage of that. But if we really took advantage, we will be able to extend the experience beyond the month itself and gradually realize again. I mean, Purushottam month, the 15th chapter of the Gita is Purushottam. Yoga, and many devotees really generally study that chapter during Purushottam month or read it every day, is one of the shortest, 20 verses. And probably, yeah, if you read that chapter, you will find many verses that basically say, like, no, you go Bhagavad Gita 15, 15, Sarvasya Jahamaridis and Ivishto, I'm everywhere, I'm situated in all beings, that's it, no? So there you have the realization of Purushottam month. Purushottam is all-pervading, present every single time, place, and circumstance. So, okay, he's not limited to this month. But maybe we needed this special celebration of Purushottam month to read chapter 15, Purushottam Yoga, to hear from Purushottam telling, I'm actually in every place at every time, place, and circumstance. Celebrate me all time. Kirtaniya Sadahari. That's what Mahaprabhu say. The celebration, kirtan, is to be performed endlessly. Satatam kirtayantamam. Kirtaniya Sadahari. Always. The prescription is not Purushottam month, kirtaniya Hari. Right? Sing the name of Hari only 1 month every 3 years. So those are some thoughts that come to my mind. But you tell me how they resound in you, Kanupriya.
Yes, this was very helpful because you showed us the complexity of this topic, I think. It's special and it's everything is special. This is somehow it sounds like a contradiction, but
Paradoxical.
Thank you.
No, thank you. And again, at the end of the day, it depends each one according to their own adhikar. Sui sui adhikare janishta saguna parikirtita bhavatam se. To acknowledge which is your adhikar, which is your capabilities and lack of them, is real virtue. To know where you're standing and acting coherently based upon that, that's real beauty. So we are invited to apply whatever I said or beyond myself, according to where we are, right? It's not there is only one way of doing the things. That's when people come and ask, so Purushottam is coming or Karti is coming or whatever is coming, what should I do, Maharaj? Which are the vows? Like, again, the question is wrong to begin with, because we are trying to just receive the all one way, only one way to do things, and there's no one way only to do things. That's kind of impersonalism. To reduce everything to one single way of being, right? Yeah. Okay, Purushottam Math. So we'll invite you for a few minutes to the breakout rooms so you can share together in groups of three, four maximum, in more private spaces, and share whatever from this discussion has touched you and what has touched, what has come, any realization, any reflections, something you may like to turn together for a few minutes, and see you back after that. So may you have a good exploration over there. Welcome. Welcome back. Hoping you have some nourishing time together. And as usual, also, we'd like to invite some of you to share a little bit more openly whatever is openly, publicly shareable, some of the jewels and insights you may have gotten in your discerning in your private rooms. So, Karuneshwari, please.
Hi, Krishna. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. I was with Kanupriya from Scotland, Switzerland, that Kanupriya. And we were really on the same page, which was really nice. And we both agreed on a couple of things that at this time, like forcing ourselves or pressurizing ourselves is just not working. Me, because we've done that for many years, and it's like a time now to let things flow more naturally. And the other thing we both agreed on, which we were really happy to hear each other say it, was that even if we're not doing all the things that we think we should do, we're constantly thinking about what it means to go forward in spiritual life, always questioning, trying to work out doubts, thinking about lectures we've heard. And that's our kind of focus on meditation at the minute, always trying to work out where am I, how am I going to go forward? And that feels like the relationship with Krishna at the minute.
Thank you. Thank you. What about Nanda Kumar? I told him and the camera froze.
No, what about now?
Now it's not frozen, so I thought you were p terrified about me inviting you to speak, but I know that's not you, so there
No,
you are.
I knew you will ask me.
They
So,
always say the same. They always say
yeah.
the same because it means everyone is terrified that I'm about to call them. So whomever is called, they will say, "I knew it." Anyhow.
Yeah, I was with the kind of Priya from Germany, the guilty one who asked the question, and with Bhadra from all the way from New Zealand, and Bhadra shared that how she had such a first she didn't knew about it for first 25 years, and then she had such experience with Narayan Maharaj that it made such an impression on her that now she naturally, spontaneously does some extra nice things in that month. And and then Kanapri also brought up idea that, yeah, what is this? There's Kartik, there's the mood, there's the all the candles, community together at evening, how it creates something very special, impressions. And I added that yes, these kind of things sometimes create a positive impressions, and sometimes when maybe we are not in sync with ourselves, or the impression is created but not so positive. And I gave an example that's I would many, many times chant my rounds. I would end up chanting them at evening, 9 o'clock, 16 rounds, and ending up hating them. And because I did it many times, then the impression about Japa became just kind of hating it.
That was not the original plan, right?
That was not the original plan. So yeah, the point was to be sensitive and caring and nurturing to our own selves, how to apply bhakti practice.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, let's continue. Let's move forward. We have a few more contributions. So next raised hands come from Chandrika from Hawaii. So welcome.
Right now I'm in a hyper localized sacred place called Mount Shasta.
Okay.
And it's kind of a spiritual mecca, not necessarily a Hare Krishna mecca, but there's been wonderful kirtan, and it's an amazing place. And I wrote this poem I wanted to share from it's from Krishna's perspective, and it was next to a beautiful river. The river flows and knows how much I want to gaze upon my beloved Radha. The river is unfazed as I pace her banks, offer thanks, and hope she will bless me with a meeting, however fleeting. She wraps around obstacles which turn her as white as bridal lace. I imagine I see Radha's face reflected in the calm eddies that ensue. But alas, I fear Radha is not here, and my entreaties appear to go unheard. Words of love flow through my mind and rhyme in endless poetic praise. If only Radha will find me in this state, perhaps I can amaze and persuade her. She is my fate. Hers is the love that surpasses all other loves I bestow. And she must know how we both glow as we bask in the radiance of our union, play flute and veena. While we dance, what words fail to express? As I undress her doubts and reservations, Radha will see beyond the distractions and infractions of this place. If only we can catch sidelong glances to send prame soaring like an eagle in the sky, eye to eye, where we simply sigh with happiness.
Jai Jai Shraddha.
Jai, Shri Radha, Jai Radhe.
I'm so Chandrika. Always a pleasure. And yeah, to be reminded of I couldn't avoid thinking about, and I don't want to sound like now comes my commentary in your poem, because a poem generally speaks for itself and better silence after that to let it sink in. But I cannot resist. Yeah, thinking how beautiful, how fortunate we are. And again, not wanting to fall into any, hopefully praying not to do so, to fall in any type of religious exclusivism while saying this. But yeah, fortunate we are, and I'm not saying we are the only ones, but in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, we have a very unique window into how the ultimate divine is. Appears in such a needy, in the good sense of the term, needy situation in terms of love, right? Despondency, divine despondency, and divine necessity, and what love creates, basically, the movement that love creates in the form of Leela, which you beautifully depicted, and the longing, and the even for the one small second of that silent glance, everything is perfectly justified, right? That's also, I'm thinking about something I read last night from a disciple of Srila Narayana Maharaj, friend of mine, Krishna Chandra Prabhu. I cannot recall exactly what he said, though I may try to find, I have my notes at hand, but because I highlighted that. But it was very much in connection to this point of unconditional, that was the word. Let's go to the search option. Oops, one second. I can leave. Yeah. Basically, this is. He was saying. He's talking about, I mean, it's an apparently disconnected topic, but it's all connected. Huh? He's sharing here his own perspective of the four regulative principles, as I've tried to do myself in my own way from a broader, deeper perspective. And when speaking about no gambling, he was talking about deceit, no gambling connection to deceit. And he will say that the attitude of deceit that resonates in gambling hopes to invest very little in order to gain a great profit from it. Right? Let me give as little as I can to get as much as I can. Very calculative. I'm very unwilling to give unconditionally. With minimal investment, one wants to receive the maximum. And then he says, but the basic attitude of pure bhakti is exactly the opposite. I will give everything and never demand anything in return. I am ready to serve Radha Krishna, even if it should bring about the greatest losing. And so on and so forth, right? And he concludes referring to the fourth verse of Shikshastakam, which Mahaprabhu depicts the stage of Ruchi, you know, what it means to get a real taste for bhakti. And he summarizes that saying, with the greatest possible investment and effort, I will never want anything in return. So again, I know that in practice we may feel I'm far away from that. That's a high ideal, but I think it's always beautiful to bear in mind that ideal, which of course you ultimately becomes fully expressed in things like the poem you just shared, Chandrika, where both Radha and Krishna are willing to, as it will be said poetically in the books of our acharyas, like willing to die millions of times just to provide the least amount of pleasure to the object of our affection, right? Millions of deaths are nothing in comparison to have been able to provide that seva. Again, in some stage of the journey, it may sound like theory and romantic, but that's the ultimate reality for us. Okay? And that's why we are here for, ultimately. We want to enter that world. So it's very important to be reminded, whether through poetry, through philosophy, in which direction we want to develop our offering, so to say, which direction the offering needs to be refined further to reach that point in a natural way, no pressure, not what neurosis or guilt, but the willingness to and realizing, right? I think that's the main thing here. When we realize the beauty, the harmony, the depth, and the grace that is emanating from that source, we will naturally be willing to give everything and know that that's still not enough price to pay, but that's as much as I can. So, but that should come from a genuine experience of what do we actually mean by Krishna, by Radha Krishna, by Mahaprabhu. And when we are in touch with that reality, we'll become overwhelmed and humbled. And again, we will be willing to give ourselves thousands of times and feel it's never enough, but from a healthy place, right? Not from a neurotic place. It's never enough. I'm so bad. I'm so falling. Because that version is there. But when you make full circle from the dysfunctional bhakti to a healthy one to a full functional bhakti, it may resemble the same externally. Mahaprabhu is saying in me, there is not even an aroma of love. And maybe for most of us at this stage of the journey, it may be healthy to say, there is love. There is some love in my life by grace, but to affirm and to acknowledge that reality in a positive way, we may need to do that to counteract some past toxic versions. But eventually, we may be again paradoxically confronting the infinite and having this subjective experience like, wow, that the vastness of infinity is such that next to it, and you may put into words, I'm close to nothing, but you are celebrating that, right? You are not feeling miserable about yourself. You are just celebrating proximity to the infinite, right? Like everyone will feel next to an ocean, right? You just like, have a glimpse on the beach. Go to the beach more often. Look at the ocean. And I mean, if you are of sane mind, you will feel insignificant. If you are standing next to in a redwood tree forest, if you are a sane mind, you will feel insignificant. insignificant, but also blessed and fortunate and humbled and full of awe and wonder and insignificant. But not only that. So it's like a blessed insignificancy. I don't know if that word exists altogether, but anyhow, you get my point. So all that to say, thank you, Chandrika. And I'm saying all that also to connect, to relate like a poem about the depiction of what's going on in the heart of the divine couple in ways that we may also find that relatable to wherever we are on the journey, and we may not feel that's just too high and that's not for me, and talk to me about the basic stuff. Not necessarily. I mean, there are ways that we can relate to the highest of the highest and also to the most basic of the most basic. The highest of the highest, because it's so high, it can become so relatable to everyone. And the basic of the basic still fill with depth and profundity. So there's no excuse not to learn from anything. Thank you.
Maharaj, you just reminded me of when Narayan Maharaj first came to Maui, and at one point he was, his English kept getting better, but at one point he was struggling with, "I am simply insign," and then everyone said insignificant. Kind of like, uh-oh.
You were not supposed to say that yourself, guys.
We were just trying to help him with his English, but oh no. But I mean, the really exalted souls, you're right, feel insignificant.
Yeah, probably you feel overwhelmed in that insignificance in a healthy way that you cannot even pronounce the word. And probably not because you don't speak good English only, but it's overwhelming because of that. But I think again, it's important to learn more and more to inhabit this land of paradox, where you can be feeling significant and feel blessed at the same exact time. Because in our dualistic mind, we still create so much separation. If it's insignificant, it must be bad. So I cannot feel insignificant. And you totally exile that possibility. So you think it's all about feeling the opposite of insignificant. And that may not be the case either. So it's important that we can progress more and more in terms of at least starting to conceive it's possible to feel both small and blessed at the same time, to feel loved and feel insignificant at the same time. These apparent contradictions get properly harmonized. And again, it can all begin in the beach looking at the ocean or hearing a poem about Sri Sri Radha and Krishna or anywhere, right? Like Srila Sivamurthy Maharaj will say, the object of your inquiry is everywhere, right? So your inquiry can start anywhere, literally, because the object of the inquiry is anywhere. So, yeah, thank you. Okay, we have how many? I want to check the raised hands and the questions. We have two more, one from Trivikram Prabhu, another one from Prem. So maybe I will skip this breakout room. We'll skip always some. And we'll go to Trivikram from New Zealand. Where is he? Oh, there he is.
All right, well, everybody. Hare Krishna. Hare Ram Maharaj. Nice to see you. I wanted to. My heart's beating like a drum at the moment. I'm sort of trying to collect my thoughts. It's always a little bit confronting to speak here, but I'll do my best. I wanted to start with a little story. That illustrates the point I would like to touch upon. And the story involves Indrajuna Swami, who most of us know as a ISKCON sannyasi, quite prominent devotee who's quite actively involved with preaching in many different frontiers. But one he's well known for is his preaching in Poland. So I actually had the fortune to go over there when I was in my younger years as a brahmachari. And of course, one of the aspects of the outreach there is their Harinam Sankirtan out in the villages and towns, and often quite historic beautiful places, all very ornate village-like European setting. So a very wonderful place to do the Harinam Sankirtan, and usually quite a big contingent of devotees would be going along and chanting the holy names with great gusto and very melodically, and you know, all sorts of instrumentation was going on. And obviously, with numbers comes quite a lot of volume. And generally speaking, it was highly received, or very well received, and people appreciated how it complemented the vibe of the tourist destinations and all these things. So, but on one particular occasion, I wasn't there, but I heard the story where this gentleman came out, and he was a little bit miffed by the spirit that was kind of almost presumptuous, this kind of this God gift to humanity kind of mood that he was picking up on, this overzealous thing. It was very loud, so he came up and he talked to Maharaj, and he said, you know, how is it you're able to come and speak, chant so loudly, and you know, and disturb those that are focused in other ways, you know, and in a way that isn't necessarily aligned with your inspiration or your vision. And Maharaj said, well, and he tried to explain to him that the idea of, you know, if sometimes if a person's about to walk over a cliff unknowingly, then you need to shout in their ear, look out, you know. And so he made a very nice illustrated example as to why sometimes, even though it may shock the person and their sensibilities, that actually a bit of volume may be required, and therefore that's the spirit in which we're coming through in this kind of quite self-appointed self-congratulatory tone. And the gentleman was respectful, but he said, yes, but sometimes that volume, that might shock the person that they fall over the cliff. Anyway, the outcome was Maharaj took this on board, and he humbly started the kirtan, and very quietly they moved off again. And for me, it illustrated at some nice points. And one is that sometimes we have a winning formula, we have a strength that we see that generally people are you know, changed or transformed by a particular approach to our presentation. We might be a kirtaneer, and we might have some musical skills, but within that, if the emphasis is so much overbearingly on the musicality, sometimes that instills a sense of elitism in the environment and the audience, that they think, yes, this is nice, this is very nice, but I can't see myself fitting into it, or I can't belong in this place. And equally, to extend that analogy, sometimes we might be a philosopher or an academic or an intellectual, and we are able to present the philosophy in a very articulate and very complete and compelling way. At the same time, we might actually create an environment where, essentially, again, the elitist kind of thing, where it's not necessarily presented, that we might even be presenting philosophically that we want a dialogue here, not a monologue, but what is inferred by the type of inferentially, I suppose you'd say, the excellence or the emphasis on the way things are presented in a very right way, doctrinally correct, philosophically correct way is there's a correct way and then there's an incorrect way sort of thing. And people feel intimidated that they can't come up to the mark. So therefore their participation isn't necessarily empowered to partake, if that makes any sense. Equally, I remember back in the day in Kirtan, sometimes the microphone would be passed around, and you know, or even in a new Sunday feast crowd, and then you'd get guests that would be suddenly asked to chant and on their own, and they'd never done it before, and it just frightened the living daylights out of them, basically, quite frankly, and you never saw them again. So I guess even within our own Tathagata Sangha, that spirit of having to participate in something, like, you know, we're just kind of volunteering people to come forward, might give them that sense of not being able to belong in that sort of environment, maybe self-imposed judgment on themselves, but still that might be the feeling that they feel is being implied by a certain kind of adhikar that's surrounding them within that environment, so to speak. Does that make any sense? So, in other words, when a strength becomes sometimes a weakness, a strength can become a weakness, and in light, it can be our Achilles heel. Like I've had many of the Aindra aficionado kirtaniers who are very, very musically, technically accomplished, but many times I've also heard people respond that they prefer the simple kirtans where they just feel like they're actually able to put their heart in that place. It's not that they don't appreciate that, but there's this obstruction in place. Yeah. Anyway, I just thought I'd bring that through because I have heard people say, yeah, they feel a little intimidated. Even one devotee who does used to come to the Tathagata Sangha groups is actually doesn't come anymore because the expectation of interaction on a personal level is like having the mic passed around, so that they can feel a little bit like, oh, if that's what we're up for here, then I think I might just bow out here.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And of course, speaking as a member of the Tathagata Sangha, let's put it that way, I do not expect, of course, this Sangha to be the place for everyone. And not that we are not willing to receive everyone, but not everyone will feel this is their place, and that's fine, right? I mean, that's okay. Just to make that point clear from my side, as the quote unquote founder of the Sangha, founder, I was found, and then I'm the founder, the founded. So yeah, I wouldn't like to think that this is creating a one sense in any form of elitism or any form of everyone has to be part of this. Also, at the same time, I wouldn't like anyone to feel, oh, I'm being excluded or I'm being asked too much. There are always situations like this, and I appreciate that you are bringing that in a general way. Of course, we are not talking publicly about specific cases. I personally do not have any expectation of people like participating publicly, though now, while you were talking, I was thinking, well, recently I've started inviting some of you to share ideas from the private group, and I'm picking them. So far, and probably that may feel a little bit intimidating to some, which was not my plan intention actually, because with the private groups, I thought, well, you can choose to join the groups or not, right? So you are not forced to join the private group, and it's fine. Not everyone joins. Just if you always join, there are people who do not join, just for you to know. Of course, I will love that everyone joins for the right reasons, because I think there is a healthy reason for us to share and get to know each other and build community by getting to know each other. But also there is place for someone, as you say, Sri Vikram Prabhu, not feeling that's the right moment or the right day, or they prefer to be more on their own. And regarding the breakup rooms, I can see, okay, you are not forced to participate, but now I'm thinking regarding the invitation to share some of the jewel from the breakout rooms. If since I'm choosing some of them, I may feel some of you a little bit intimidated by, oh, maybe I'm, as we were joking with Nanda Kumar, I knew you were going to call me. And as you can see, I do not ever, not, none of your predictions are accurate, because if you're all feeling I will call you, I'm only calling one or two people. But I don't want to create that in anyone. It's complex, right? Because for some people, oh, they are being invited to talk and they feel, oh, I'm being invited to talk, I'm being invited to participate. For some others, that very same exact thing may be a cause of concern. So I'm just now live with all of you thinking, well, probably better adjustment will be for me not to ask people to share what they talked in the private room, but to invite those who would like to raise their digital hand to do it more voluntarily. Because, I mean, if you know me, you know that I'm not a person who likes to force upon people or to demand, tell people what to do, and you do that, and now you, and now you. Maybe the same, I don't know, in the beginning when I'm invited someone to say some few words of Mangalacharan and blessing the meeting. I don't know, for me it's beautiful to invite like what Bhadra shared today or others at different times. But I know that for some it may be like, oh, I cannot do it. And for me it will be great, even if some of you who feel that tell me, Maharaj, I cannot do it. And I'm like, great, no problem. Let's call someone else until I find someone who can do it. But I also understand that for some, it may be even uncomfortable to have to say, I cannot do it. So you see that it's tricky. When it gets tricky, because
Yeah,
I
take
also
time.
don't want to be utterly sensitive, calculating every possible thing I'm saying, not to feel, make anyone feel bad about it, because it loses some spontaneity and some organic participation, right? So it's tricky. That's my answer basically. I'm not giving any solution. I'm open and I'm willing, of course, to adjust as long as we do not compromise spontaneity and trust and confidence. But I will say in general, I understand, of course, if someone feels not about participating in an overt way. But also I think it's fair to say that Tathagata Sangha is in big part a lot about participation. But not participation in terms of we expect you to participate, but we think it's a healthy thing to do as long as we do it in a safe environment. And I can understand if someone doesn't feel that, there's place to take some distance for sure. So that's as much as I can say now, and that I will sit with that and contemplate that more. And let's see what comes from that homework. But yeah, thanks for sharing. I mean, I appreciate, for me that's important that we can sit and talk about anything and everything. And this is a public meeting that eventually is uploaded to YouTube, so everyone will be
Exactly.
seeing this, and it's okay, right? It's not like, oh no, people will see that someone joined the Sangha and is no longer coming because, oh, we wanted to look perfect in the eyes of the world. No, that's not what we are here for. So I hope this also is somehow a way of a testimony to trying to deal with things as openly, as humanly as possible.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, you've dealt with that. I personally find this sangha is very healthy for me personally in terms of the interactive element there. But I totally also appreciate having gone through a culture of people. Previously, I remember conveying to my spiritual authority back in the day how New Zealanders are by nature quite known to be quite independent and inspired in their own individual ways and by as you know the term is rugged individualists or people that are very innovative is another quality there. That's just the positive side, of course, probably also quite neurotic and introverted in some ways. But the whole point of being able to highlight what the quality is and work with that as an authority or a person that's trying to empower a group of people and look at their general psychophysical karma, then that seems to be a way that you would actually make good progress and utilizing that to engage them in the service of the divine. So I presented that point to my then spiritual authority, and he sort of said almost in a dismissive way, "We wish them well." In other words, I'm not really interested. You either get on board with my program or you know, you're on your own. And I just thought, well, that's kind of a great opportunity lost in a sense. Now, people may have their inabilities, but if there's the sensitivity to realize that if they can be accommodated, and if we have the capacity to also accommodate them, sometimes it's not possible according to our own place to actually accommodate others, then it would seem to be that's the goal in terms of trying to find that golden thread that weaves us all together and highlight that in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I agree with what you just say also. No one tries to be accommodating, but also I will say part of that accommodating spirit is allowing people not to feel that they can accommodate themselves in your right? Harmony, in the name of harmony, I want to accommodate everyone. I almost basically force you to somehow or other find your place here. That doesn't feel too accommodating, right? That doesn't feel too free. So I think there is an important point to make in terms of love requiring freedom. And because I love you, if you need to go somewhere else for genuine reasons, you are totally free to do so. And if for genuine reasons you are called to return, so to say, whether it's to a group or to a personal relationship, there's the freedom to do so, right? So yeah. Yes, learning to love, learning all that love implies, and freedom, and getting to know each other, and acknowledging our capacities and limitations, and learning to communicate what we feel, what we need in proper ways, whether it is publicly, privately, personally, collectively. It's an ongoing art, right? So, yeah. There's no perfect community, just in case. Perfect Sangha, right? I mean, perfect Sangha is Golok Vrindavan, and that's an ongoing process of further refining their own perfection. So, yeah.
You, as Prabhupada said, utopianism is impersonalism. So,
yeah. Remember, you shared with me that reference. Beautiful. Yeah, because when we overexpect something, whether on a guru or a group or a sangha, that in itself is the beginning of the problem. Like you are projecting too much, and it's a form of, as we always say, when you overidealize anything, you are dehumanizing that thing. Whether you overidealize a guru, a guide, a person, a group, those are forms of impersonalism or dehumanization. Instead of having to accept what it takes to be human and go through the messiness and beauty of messiness of being human and a sadhaka and learning and growing together, right? So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's go for a few minutes of break up and continue reflecting together about this interesting topics for sure. So, to you, Baxan. Welcome back. Hope you had some nourishing time. And before we go to the last question from Prem, I'd like to invite whomever wants. I'll try to be a good boy, invite you to raise your digital hand, whomever you would like to share some jewels you found that are publicly shareable with some of us from the breakout rooms. If you are too shy, I will have to pick you. So it's your part of the game also. There you have it,
I'll
John.
just say, Maharaj, that we all need each other's prayers. That was something that I shared with my two partners.
Thank you. And you have a beautiful tree growing out of your head. Beautiful. Badra.
That was interesting. Trivikram's statements and questions kind of opened a lot of areas to look at. And I was just sharing with Nandakumar Das that even just 5 years ago, what to speak of 25 or 30 years ago, I would have had my heart beating like a drum, you know. Being asked to speak without any preparation. But nowadays, I love it. Nowadays, it's just a wonderful kind of fulfilling. It's like fulfilling. So there's something fulfilling about being able to just speak what's happening for you spontaneously. But I realized from my own experience in life that not everyone is at that point. Not everyone is on that particular point on the path where they are made to feel included and welcomed or appreciated by that request. Some people might feel just, oh, you know, completely put off as so it's interesting to recognize how I need to be aware of that when dealing with anybody.
Thank you. Yeah, belonging takes different shapes, so to say, right? So we want to promote belonging, but how it will be perceived by everyone, and it will be different. And I was thinking, of course, during the break, address my own situation, and also was thinking, well, how to do it, what's the shape to take, as you were saying, Badra, some people may feel, you yourself in the past may have felt intimidated by the possibility of just having to say something in a public forum, and I can totally understand that. In fact, there are a few members, I won't give names, of course, but there are currently right now connected live that I know they will prefer not to talk publicly, and they have told that to me. So me knowing that, I will not invite them, not because I have anything personal with them, but just because I respect that. So that was kind of my mentality so far regarding the particular case that Trivikram Prabhu referred to, which of course I don't know who the person is. But for me, it's more like, okay, I will trust that the person may communicate with me privately and let me know about that. So I stop terrifying the person about the possibility of calling them. So I try to be sensitive. But again, I can understand that for some reason, maybe the person preferred to, I don't know, to talk to him and not to me or whatever the case. It's totally fine. Again, I'm not, who am I to, no, they have to talk to me first. I mean, but yeah, it's a delicate navigation because, yeah, I mean, it's a lesson for me always to be more empathic and to acknowledge the endless varieties of what every unique person needs, since we speak about radical personalism. So there is a lot there, but also, yeah, sometimes in practical terms, it's challenging because some people just may feel triggered by, I don't know, by me not wearing visible tilak, or my me wearing this t-shirt and not a chador, or not having my dand on my hand. And I'm not stigmatizing that people. It's what they need, but I cannot fully adapt to their needs also, right? So that's always the creative tension there. Okay, I am myself. I do things in a certain way. I try to be accommodating, and we try to be, but at the end of the day, we want to be flexible, but there is a line where maybe we may not be able to adjust to the satisfaction of everyone, and it's okay. And it's not that the other person is bad either, right? It's just that, but we have to try. I totally agree that it's healthy exercise to try to hear and listen and adjust as much as we can to make everyone belong in their unique journey. And if after doing that, still there is something going on, it may be a natural revelation that some people will need to find certain place or certain sangha, and that's not a tragedy, right? It's, again, it's not like no, everyone should be here with us, because that's kind of like a, like, I don't know, sounds like a totalitarian regime or something. Everyone aligned here and nobody else outside. So yeah, releasing as a form of love in certain cases, no, yeah. Yeah, as long as there is, again, proper concern in the background, not just, no, I'm releasing as a form of love and you're actually being indifferent or you're actually being unwilling to adapt. So I'm not, of course, there's a difference between that. Kanupriya is raising her hand. One more jewel, please.
Yes, a very short one. I just wanted to say, I think it is very, very wonderful that we are invited to share, because very often before I met this wonderful Sangha, I experienced it's most of the time a monologue. If I was in a Sangha, I was listening and it was interesting. A lot of questions arised in my head, but I could not bring them up. And I feel it is very precious that we have such a Sangha where we are invited to share thoughts and are invited to ask questions. And I was asking myself also, if I would be asked to say a prayer at the beginning, I maybe would be a little bit terrified to do so, because it's a very personal thing. But then I thought, but Kanupriya, you can also say no. And this is also a step forward to me. Let's say if I'm invited, I can say no. This is also possible. So nothing to worry about. And maybe there is a day I feel also I would love to share a prayer. But up to that moment, I have a choice. And so this is...
Yeah, I will invite you Saturday then. You can say no, and that no.
I can say no, and that's fine too.
That no will be your prayer. Why not?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And yeah, of course, thanks for sharing what you mentioned about giving the opportunity for others to share in a sharing like this. And it's not just a monologue. And I think that's the main reason why we are opening the door for questions and comments and the private rooms to share among yourself. I feel and I've experienced it's very inspiring and empowering. But again, I know that for some people that may not be the case. And it's, again, totally fine. It's not like we are the superior ones who share openly, and those who do not fit into that, oh, they have their own stuff to work on too. No, we don't want to create that type of hierarchy there. But yeah, I totally agree that why we are doing what we are doing, how we are doing, is because of the reasons you mentioned. And because I've heard from almost all of you, the inspiration that comes to you because of that. So that's what keeps me doing all that stuff, right? It's not just like, I mean, I like it myself. It's not that I don't like it, but also I'm seeing that for most of you it works. But at the same time, I'm willing to, yeah, if for someone doesn't work, how to adjust it in a certain way that what's working for others still continues to work also, right? So that's always the balancing there. Yeah. Okay, Jamuna, and then we'll go to Prem, who has a question. It's
okay.
Working. Well, I invite you to raise your digital hand. I have more and more raised.
Okay, I'll be really quick. I just wanted to show appreciation. Everything that Kanupriya said was, I was like, yes, yes. And also I can say for myself that sometimes I've found meeting, going into the breakout rooms overwhelming, and I haven't been able to do it. And there's the don't, not now option, which I've clicked many, many, many times. And you know, speaking with people has been something that's been overwhelming for me. But because of this group, I'm actually overcoming it, and I'm actually able to, I look forward to meeting people now. It's a new thing, but I look forward to actually, it's a little for me, but I'm excited, and I'm really grateful for the growth that this group has given me, because it isn't, I haven't experienced it anywhere else. And I've discovered I have a little bit of a voice, which I'm going to be quiet now, but I just wanted to say thank you for helping me grow.
Thank you for helping us grow as well, for sure. Yeah. Okay, we'll go to one last question, exploration, quest, offering from Prem. If I'm not mistaken, that was the last raised hand. So, Prem, invited to mute yourself, more than welcome.
I'll preface by saying I'm not one of those people comfortable speaking in situations like this, but this question's every week. I say, I'm going to ask this question this week. I'm going to do it this week.
Yeah, fine.
Have not done it, but when you opened the group, same with your conversation with Jai Jagannath, and mentioned about that we should not be, or try not to be cynical or hopeless about what's going on in the world. And my question kind of goes in, is involved with what's going on in the world. So I figured, all right, this is the week. And to preface it, I live in the US, so there's a lot going on. And my question really revolves around what is my responsibility, or is any action required on my part? Because there's things, I get emotional, I talk about, there's things going on that are just so difficult. Like, for some, I'm not a political person. I mean, other than when I, protested the Vietnam War, I haven't really been involved in it. But this whole point of this that's going on with immigration has, I don't know, for some reason, it just breaks my heart every time. And right now, there's something even going on in my own state, very close to where I am. There's a lot of people that are just being put in a detention center that is privately funded and deprived of food, medical care, things like that. And I have done some protest, and I have tried to do some memorial for people that had died in ICE custody. But and I've tried to talk to devotees, and I get, oh, I don't listen to the news, or, well, it's Kali Yuga. So I feel like maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some kind of action isn't required. So excuse me. I guess I'm asking for guidance. And then even if it's only prayer, I think, or I say, just pray then. I don't even know how to pray about it. But so I'm not sure why it tugs at my heart so strongly. But there's a reason that maybe there is something I'm supposed to do. So that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Prem. I appreciate your sharing totally. And that's the ongoing question, right? Between, as my beloved Father Richard Rohr will say, no action and contemplation, right? Like we are practicing spiritual life, and how much of it can should translate into action in the world, and how, which shape, which form, in which way, which of course there are no easy answers, because it may take different shapes. Something that always comes to my mind, of course, I'm remembering a few podcasts I did with some people. I cannot avoid sometimes thinking about podcasts I did when questions are asked to me. I remember we did one nice one with Hari Kirtan Prabhu from Washington, D.C., about the politics and bhakti and dharma, and how much a devotee can be involved in social action and social change. And of course, agreeing that it's possible, and not only possible, but probably necessary. Though it may not take the same form in every single case. But also, I'm remembering one podcast we did many years ago, a few years ago, with Father Adam Buco. And he wrote a book called Follow Your Heartbreak, basically. And this is a famous idea which stands somehow in contrast with Joseph Campbell's idea, Follow Your Bliss, which I have nothing against Joseph Campbell. The first time I read about Krishna was from Joseph Campbell, so I'm indebted to him. And I get the point of follow your bliss, but sometimes there is no bliss, there is heartbreak, and you cannot just replace the heartbreak with bliss, so to say, right? Because we can become, and I've seen that happening many times in devotional communities, just about happy, happy, joy, joy. And no, sometimes you're heartbroken. And it's okay, and you need to do something with that. The heartbreak is a portal. It's telling you something. So why your heart is being broken? And I'm not asking you to reply here in detail publicly, but all of us are invited to ask ourselves, okay, I feel that my heart is cracking when witnessing this particular situation, whatever it may be. Okay, follow your heartbreak. Where is your heartbreak leading you to? And probably will lead you to some particular type of action in the world or doing something, as you can, as you said, even it could be prayer. Though prayer doesn't look like action or like activism, but prayer changes the world for sure. I mean, I mean someone like Thomas Merton, for example, some of you may be familiar with him. He was a Trappist monk from the Vietnam time, Vietnam War time. And he was a recluse, basically. He never left his hermitage. Only time he left the hermitage, basically he died, interestingly enough, while he was on a tour in Asia. But he never left the hermitage. But he was such a participant of what was going on the world at that time, whether praying, whether writing about it, he was aware of what was going on in the world, and he deeply prayed about it. Then he wrote beautiful contemplations about that, all from that spot in the world, his hermitage. So just to give an example of someone who doesn't leave his house, so to say, can be deeply doing something that can change the world. And it doesn't mean we have to do what Thomas Merton is doing. Just asking, and it may be a daily question. Again, what's my heartbreak asking of me today? What's the shape it needs to take today? For me, not for you, for them, for the neighbor. Each one may be hopefully working in a complementary way. So each one is putting their own. It's not that everyone needs to be doing the same thing. That in itself is a problem to think like that. So I think it's a very personal question, a very necessary one. That's why I'm not during here to tell you what to do, because that will be too much for me. But I will say as much as follow your heartbreak. Like take the heartbreak as a guide, no? As some breadcrumbs that are taking you somewhere and are inspiring you, the change. Be the change you want to see in the world, as Mahatma Gandhi will say. And many times, I know there are different views. Some people will think start locally and that will have a global impact. And some others will say, well, try to go globally and it will impact the locals. And I wouldn't say one is good, the other is bad. Again, for me, both are correct and can complement each other according to where we are. Someone is in a position of creating a global change for good, please do it. I mean, use power, position, fame, money for good, right? Because all those assets are just Shakti, are just energy that are destined to be employed in service to God and humanity. There's nothing wrong with the word power. It's just what you do with the power, right? Krishna is the most powerful one, and he does pretty well with power. So, and if we don't have those types of forms of power, there you can always resort to prayer, which is very powerful in anonymity, especially powerful when it is anonymous, I will say. And whatever options in between, again, each one will find their own call. But I will say, yeah, it's important not to turn a blind eye to what's going on in the world and to relate to that in ways that can foster compassion and empathy, and see that as part of the spiritual project. We don't need to create a separation between action in the world and my prayer life. No, actually, the challenge and the ongoing question maybe is how to keep integrating this into a more cohesive, like merging, so to say, no, like putting the two together, right? So I mean, I think the fact that you have the question and you dare to ask the question and you are shedding tears because of the question in itself shows a lot, right? I'm not saying that's it. You don't need to do anything else, Prem, relax. I'm not saying that. The fact that all that took place in itself, there's a lot behind that, I will say. And I trust that you will be able to follow the trail of your tears that they have in the US, the trail of tears, right? We have to follow our own trail of tears, what breaks our heart and translate that into some form of relief work of sorts. Whatever is realistic at hand for us, again, not comparing, not trying to play superhero and doing something that is way beyond our current situation, but we can always do something. And let's not underestimate the power of sincere, genuine action for change and how that can transform lives. And one life transformed, that can transform, a few lives transformed well enough, that can transform the whole world in big ways. So, yeah, I will say let's not underestimate the effect we can have in the world from a humble place, but let's not underestimate that what can come if we follow our heartbreak from a genuine place? What can disclose there? I don't know if that helps. Sorry if I'm sounding too generic, but it's
No,
very personal in one sense.
it is, and it helped a lot. It really did.
Yeah. Yeah,
Thank
thank you.
you. Thank you.
Yes, very intimate, very personal. But again, I trust your discernment in and the result of your own prayers in terms of bringing clarity of what to do today. And it's not an easy question any single day. I mean, I'm asking that question every single day. What to do today? What's expected of me, but what I am invited to do today, not tomorrow, today. And every day is the same question, and many times I don't have an answer to the question. It's not that you just haven't, oh, today I'll do this, and today this is my contribution to the world, and tomorrow I know what I will be doing. Sometimes it just there's no answer. There's just a question the whole day. And the next day and the next week, and sometimes an answer comes. But I think that's big part of the change is just the willingness and the courage to sit with the question, because it's a difficult question, it's an uncomfortable question, it's not a question with any easy answer. So having the willingness to stay with the question all the time it requires long enough, that in itself, whenever an answer comes, that answer will have powerful impact. So even if your day or the weeks pass by with sitting with the question with no apparent answer, that in itself is a crucial part of the process, and how real answers eventually come arise from, right? The most transforming answers, I will say, come from long sitting days with uncomfortable questions. So, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Let's go to one final breakout room today. Those who would like to continue exploring in small groups, how we are, yeah, whatever you would like, but in connection probably to how we are navigating whatever is surrounding us in life, how we feel with this notion of following our heartbreak, and whatever else needs to be brought at the table. So, see you back in a few minutes. Welcome you all back. Hoping you were able to follow your heartbreak and find the things that break your heart, which means the things that you care for, the thing that you love, and therefore break your heart. So that's a great school of love in it unto itself. So thanks so much again for that question, Prem, and for all of you for the willingness to participate in all the various online social experiments of Swami Padmanabha, like this one. So blessed to be part of this with each one of you, and send you my greetings from Kali. And next Saturday, hoping to meet you next Saturday, I'll be back in Ananda Ashram, North Carolina. So looking forward to that. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Samaveda Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Bo, Panchakalpataru Vischa. Kripa sindhu bhyaiva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo.